Friends, hello, and welcome to Never Post's first mailbag episode. This is very exciting, where we will be responding to a selection of thoughts shared by our listeners via website comment, email, voice memo, and voicemail to our phone number. As a reminder, if you ever want to do any of those things, you can find a list of all of the ways to get a hold of us in the show notes of every episode and on the website, neverpo.st. Before we get started responding to comments and voice memos and stuff, let's go around our Riverside call and just very briefly say who is here. All of our video is off because my internet is bad, so no one else can see that my pointer finger is on my nose, signifying that I will not go first to say that I am here.
Brutal.
Brutal. I'm Audrey Evans, and I am a researcher, producer, many hats.
I'm Hans Buto. I'm senior producer on the show.
I'm Georgia. I'm a producer on the show.
I'm Jason Oberholzer. I'm executive producer on the show.
I'm Mike. I'm the host. I'm also here. So a few things that I want to stress before we get into responding to things directly. This is what you're about to hear is nowhere close to all of the comments and stuff that we received. We loved all of them. They were all really good. And if we don't get to them in this mailbag episode, please do not take it personally. Please do not take it as a sign that we do not want to hear from you. Send us a message or a voicemail again. You know, we only have so much space to respond to everything. And sort of on a similar note, if you are listening to this sometime in the future, you know, like weeks or months from now, do not consider the existence of this mailbag episode to mean that you can't send us your thoughts about things that we talk about here. In the future, you know, we'll have space in other mailbag episodes for older segments. So please feel free. Don't feel like you can't talk to us about something or send us messages about stuff that's older. We still want to hear from you. We still want to hear about your thoughts on those things. So they're always in play. All right. Let's get started. Everybody ready to talk about some comments?
Woo!
Hell yeah.
For anyone who needs a refresher, in episode zero, we talked with Geeta Jackson, Alex Sujong Laughlin, and Rusty Foster about being workers at and for independent media cooperatives. We got one comment about this on the website, and it's from Alex Vieira. And I want to apologize ahead of time for anybody whose name I butcher the pronunciation of. Alex wrote a comment about how they had just joined a startup and they're working a lot and the problems that they are tackling are quite large. The goals are really big and they're not sure whether or not the goal is so large that it's something that could even be tackled by a looser sort of co-op structure. And so they are wondering, are their goals big enough that they can't be addressed by the co-op structure, or is there a way that that model works at scale?
I wonder if this question is more thinking about if there are goals that are too big to be addressed by a co-op, or if there are an amount of people that need to come along for the project that are too numerous to effectively be run as a co-op. So I remember we were talking about anarchism a while back, which is not dissimilar from a co-op, and the challenge of growing anarchism, and meaning how one vets and includes new people into the incredibly bespoke and specific rule sets of an anarchic structure. So I think the same challenge would apply at scale for a co-op group. If you can select the people who are involved by some sort of process that helps you manage how and why people are included and what they need to do, I suspect you can get fairly large. If there are obligations for people being involved or an amount of people who need to get involved, I imagine that is where the tension would come from.
I think that's right. I think there's scale of idea and then there's scale of project working on that idea. And those two things can be commensurate in size or they can be actually very separate in size. I mean, I'd be curious though to see if, do you all feel like a nation state is a co-op, like the Republic model? Is that a co-op that is just too big?
Too big. We just can't do it.
Whoa. Can't quite function, obviously.
I wonder if also there's an element of time here too, where it's like there are ideas that maybe cannot be accomplished in a horizontally or like laterally organized group of people if you need them accomplished at a quick turnaround or like brutally fast deadlines. Maybe you do need some sort of intense hierarchical authoritative structure like a startup or a corporation in order to just have the person at the top being like, do it like this. And you do that because you fear me and you want your job. And it needs to be done in 2 months.
Yes.
Yeah, I'd love to hear more about what the goals are that they feel that the structure is like uniquely situated to help them reach that set of goals. Because I don't see any reason why the goals themselves would determine whether or not a co-op would be, you know, the best. It's more about the politics of how you want to get your work done and how expeditiously you want to get it done and who is it for? This may be the bigger question that brings up for me.
Our next comment is from Oisin Brogan, who has a question about the tween fashion segment from episode one. Just a quick refresher. In episode one, Georgia talked to Professor Elizabeth Wissinger about the market forces which have caused the disappearance of tween fashion. And Oisin asks, in the first piece, I feel like I missed some nuance or line of thought, but I'm wondering why age got left behind as a feature in the social media and algorithmic space that is the modern internet. At one point, Georgia talks about how you don't want to limit your potential virality by describing your look as for one age group, but then later how you can shoot for goblin core. I guess what I didn't follow slash am asking is why the latter is useful for the algorithm, but the former is not. Georgia, any responses there?
Oh, yes. I think it's truly just the fact that the internet is this flattening space that apart from certain algorithmic signifiers, I could see much of the same content that someone, I don't know, 20 years younger than me would be seeing. I think there's just more space for overlap because the internet is almost like the universe and that it is constantly expanding and has just this vastness that's sort of impossible to understand or imagine. But we still want categorization and grouping of our interests. But I think it just is the nature of the internet to sort of shift away from something like age being a signifier to your aesthetic, your vibe, the kind of person you see yourself as, like these sort of vaguer identifying terms as being more useful.
Are you saying that like the specificity of targeting available is making it so that age is more limiting than it is helpful? Because I think probably, I don't know, the golden age of Nielsen ratings or television, all you could really do was, you know, age demographic cuts through something. But it turns out there's goblin core across all ages. And so if you're going to accept that, you might as well just throw ages out so you get all your good little goblins in the team.
Yeah, goblin core, the great equalizer. I mean, yeah, basically, I think it's sort of trading one format of categorization for another. It is sort of strange, and I don't think there's one way to do this correctly or incorrectly. I think it is just sort of the nature of the way the internet and the social internet especially is structured to kind of encourage grouping around vibe and aesthetic.
Next, we got this voicemail from someone talking about posting disease and posters madness. And just as a reminder, this is something that I talked to Bijan Steven about the impulse that a lot of people have to post online, even when it is not in their best interest. And this voicemail goes,
symptoms of posting disease include posting because you're lonely and you're seeking connection the only way you know how. And it is all definitely a form of addiction. Literally talked to my therapist about this recently, about how scrolling social media is a form of addiction where you are looking for that easy, feel good dopamine moment because you're in stress about something else that you can't fix right now. I think all of that can be considered symptoms of posting disease.
So the part that I just want to focus on is the part where they describe posting as a way to gain some control or to find a little bit of a dopamine hit when you are maybe a little bit anxious or upset or worried about something else that you can't control.
I am confused in that it seems like the thing you have the least control over is to have posted. in a world of I'm not sure what's going to happen next and I can't control this, why would I put something online?
It's almost like the snake eating its tail, like this like endless loop problem. Or when people get nervous and they can't stop talking, even though they know they're not supposed to talk or that they can't stop themselves from talking.
I certainly feel that way about scrolling. Were they just describing like doom scrolling? Because I think that's the, if I can just ingest enough information, I will stop feeling bad about this. And it
or like,
doing
I wonder
opposite.
What's next. I wonder what's next. The next thing's going to be good. The next thing's going to be interesting. The next thing's going to change my life.
Yeah, I think posting disease is that, but for posting.
People like posting. I mean, I guess they must like posting that much, but
Is it about the post? Is it more about the attention that they're getting? Is that what you're saying, Mike? It's about like I'm gonna post and then maybe I'll get an amazing or I'll get any sort of acknowledgement. I think the thing you're addicted to is the reaction.
Yeah, I think it's both things. I think that you feel some amount of power and agency by putting your thoughts on the internet, and I think that you are then rewarded for making that decision through when you gain attention, whether it's good or bad. You can control that. You can modulate what you say and how and when in order to get a bigger or smaller response depending upon what you want. And I think it's like, or you know, what you're looking for. I think when you look at the people who are the characteristic sufferers of posting disease that we talked about, you know, Graham, JK, Elon, etc., they are people who can't help themselves, right? They are always looking for, it seems, that additional reinforcement that they get through posting.
I'm also interested in what they were saying about, on a smaller scale, if someone's really lonely and they want to post as a way of fostering connection, having some kind of reaction, some kind of relationship. I think there's also something there in that smaller case. You know, this isn't Elon, this is just like somebody in which it's almost like removing it from your brain and making it an actual thing. Do you know what I mean? Where it's it's just this, it suddenly it's a tangible, real in the sense that it exists in a space that
you externalize.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. That I think that can be kind of a satisfying in a very lizard brain base way of being like, get this out of me.
It's like definitionally therapeutic.
Yeah, definitely.
I can also speak on this from a position of somebody who had a self-imposed posting regimen at one time in their life, where I felt obligated to post 12 times a day for about 5 years running I Love Charts for the reason that it vaguely felt like the right content strategy, and it was just a habit that I got into, and it kept things growing. It felt kind of nice 12 times a day, each time I'd press the post button, and then was immediately followed by fear that the thing I put up would not do what I expected it to do. And it was 12 little moments of happiness followed by the rest of the day of dread and watching numbers between when I got to get another post up to maybe redress the error of the last one not doing as well or try to ride the wave if it did better than I thought. There's a reason I hard burned out and went cold turkey on posting after 5 years of this.
That makes sense to me. That's my relationship with posting too. I get it. It's small urge. I make a small post and then I'm immediately filled with the anxiety of being seen.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that speaks to sort of the fundamental tension of posting and maybe what makes it poisonous is that one maybe looks for a sense of control through posting and what they only find is the surrender of control once the things that you are saying are just out in the world, externalized on their own, doing whatever it is that they do, you sort of realize that they're just out there. And so there are two ways that you can respond to that. You can say, well, I'm going to do this less, or when I do it, I'm going to be more careful about it, or you think, well, the only way to address a post is with more posts, and then down the rabbit hole you go.
Yeah, completely. I mean, again, it's that snake eating its tail thing. It just goes and goes and goes forever.
Our next comment is from Madison Swartz, who sent an email about, I'm just going to read it because it's good. Although I can viscerally feel the difference between thoughtfully created media and posting disease, sometimes I wonder where the actual line is. The concept of another guy with a podcast has reached mimetic status because of the proliferation of dudes who think they have something interesting to say by virtue of being a man who has a thought. At best, many are pointless and annoying, and at worst are vectors for hateful politics and disinformation. To me, they represent the ultimate posting disease, being so compelled to share your thoughts and so convinced your thoughts are valuable and unique that you buy equipment and try to monetize it. Although Never Post feels a lot more intentional, and it seems like the irony of titling a podcast Never Post wouldn't be lost on this team, I feel like it's a cop-out to say it's better or different just because I like what it has to say more. I would be curious to hear your motivations for writing and posting this show, why this podcast by a guy about stuff is different, and more broadly, when it is interesting and important for people to put their thoughts into the world. I don't...
Let's go.
I will add that Madison, when Madison introduces themselves, they do say, I'm currently in a third year PhD. I'm a third year PhD student whose research is deeply concerned with what counts as interesting and valuable knowledge. So... I feel like we might be about to explain Madison's job to them. Which is maybe a kind of trap that they have set for us.
You tell us, Madison. Come on in.
Yeah.
Get Madison Hans and Jason and I, as the people who have spent the longest directly engaged in making this show, had no shortage of extreme anxiety being three middle-aged white guys with facial hair who have long worked in audio and in various ways together. Making a podcast that is men talking about stuff.
We all like board games and noise music.
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, boy. I play country now. I'm back in the diatonic.
Audrey, they're in the walls.
I know. I want to know what they have to say for themselves.
So the way that we talked about this is that this is a sort of oblique answer to this, in that we are exactly the people who in this industry are able to spend thousands of unpaid hours taking the risk to try to get a show off the ground that acts as a platform for people who aren't us. And it's going to be a little while before we get to fully realize that dream. But like, you know, the next episode, hopefully, fingers crossed, if everything works out right, is going to have zero segments hosted by me. So like, you know, the idea is that this eventually does not become my podcast where I share my thoughts, but a podcast where people can share their thoughts about the internet. But Madison, yes, you have correctly identified and called out a massive anxiety held by the team, or me at least.
And a massive accountability that everyone should be held to. We should be asking this question of every project that we see. This is a skepticism that I appreciate being in the world and being applied. Like, yes, bring this to everything. This is great. One of my great hopes for this project is that it's actually us asking a lot more questions than giving opinions and answers.
Yeah.
And allowing other people platform to be able to be in dialogue with each other, to be in dialogue with audience, and dialogue with us.
The things that to me differentiate a podcast or any piece of media that is genuinely interested and respectful versus one that is just a vanity project is this combination of curiosity and responsibility and respect. This idea of a guy with a podcast sharing his every precious thought, the implication there is that guy assumes he's an expert. No one needs to check him. No one needs to vet him on anything. He just knows and he's goes and shares his thoughts with the world and they're so grateful for it. Whereas I think what is so precious about this show, I mean, I'm biased, and shows like this, is that there is this curiosity and lack of pride of like, I would much rather talk to someone who has done this, has studied this subject, has dedicated their life to it for decades, than, I don't know, muse about it for 20 minutes. That to me is like, what's the point of me doing this if not to learn and share that learning with other people who are also curious?
Yeah, let's learn together.
Our next comment is an email from JDNK, and this is about the tween fashion segment. Regarding trends, I'm led to wonder how much changes in how people experience advertising led to the homogenization of styles across age ranges that's being described. For example, if it's 2007, I'm watching As Told by Ginger, and my mom's watching Damages, and we're being exposed to not just different advertising, but different stylistic sensibilities, different clothes sold at different places with different approaches. We make different choices because of those different influences, and that's the magic of fashion. In the example of the mom and daughter on TikTok who've adopted the same style, what stands out to me is not just that they found themselves in the same niche, but that the niche is style influencers who are at once entertainment and advertisement, and probably sent both of them to the same affiliate link. Georgia is snapping in the air.
Advertainment.
Advertisement.
No, advertisement's
better. I think all entertainment is entertisement at this point.
How entertaining.
Georgia, take it away. What do you have to say?
Okay. I love this. I mean, this is just the flattening, right? Like, it's the flattening of everything. Rather than have, you know, As Told by Ginger and Damages existing in very different places, you have everything shoved into one place, granted a very big place, the social internet, that is kind of corralled to a degree in the sense that I'm not getting content about Bluey, for example, or like Paw Patrol or whatever, but like I'm not really getting anything that is particularly specific to my age group because that's not really what matters anymore.
I have another question for you, Georgia.
Yes.
And I wonder if this factors into it too. When you talk about 2007 versus now, you're talking also about different lengths of continuum of nostalgia, where I think about TMNT a lot for a lot of reasons, but I think about TMNT specifically in this instance because you have so many dads my age who are showing their children Ninja Turtles and are raising their children on Ninja Turtles and Star Wars and Marvel and all of the things that they grew up on. And that continuum is the same. There's a bunch of reboots of everything. Everything is now streaming and people are rediscovering the Golden Girls and rediscovering Full House and rediscovering sharing it with other generations. And so unlike where you used to have the entertainment of one generation was walled off, now it seeps through and you have fashion also has noticeably not changed in the past 25 to 30 years in meaningful big ways as it did every decade for a long time before. So when you're watching 90210, when you're 13 and watching 90210 with your mom because your mom loved it, those fashions actually look recognizable and kind of hip to you. Like, that's no reason that they can't also be aspirational for you just as they were for mom. And suddenly there's a blending on all these levels that suddenly starts to happen. Am I making something up or does that feel like it could be possible?
Oh, I think that's totally possible. I would tweak it ever so slightly in that I think you're right that fashion hasn't really changed in a super outrageous way. There's a lot of sort of, you know, folding in on itself and things repeating. And I think that's also a component of the flattening of the social internet in regards to fashion, in that trends are, the trend cycle is so fast. All of these fashion trends are so nostalgic and so quick to kind of come in and out. So like you have the resurgence of low-rise pants, for example, but then you also have countless other pieces of clothing and trends that will come in on top of that or in alignment with that at the same time, and they'll get swapped out for each other. Like it's this sort of hodgepodge of all these different aesthetics coming and going, coming in fashion, coming out of fashion, that turns everything again into this like flat, like collage.
Do you agree though, that even though it seems like many different vernaculars of fashion are currently colliding, that has led to a recognizable style?
I think it's impossible to say that right now. That's such, I mean, it's a cop out to do that. But truly, like, I think I remember when Y2K fashion was coming back in style and being like, oh, yeah, I guess that was the whole thing. The jelly shoes and, you know.
And that was only like what, a year or two ago?
A year or two ago, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, yeah. Basically. It might have been a little further back from that. Y2K stuff has had a chokehold for a while, almost to the point where it never went out of fashion.
That is maybe what I'm talking about when I say that there's this sort of recognizable aesthetic within the hodgepodge of this flattening. That it's like there is at base something sort of Y2K about it that you then place a lot of other stuff on top of. And maybe it's just that I live on the border of Bushwick. And so everybody just sort of looks away. And that's who I see all the time.
Listen, the neighborhood I live in Chicago is very similar in that regard. So okay. I think there is a degree to which I'm like, everyone has a rat tail now, right?
Yeah. Okay. Exactly. Okay. Yeah. We are having the same experience.
Yeah. Everyone's getting eyebrow piercings.
Yeah. Everyone's t-shirts are both somehow way too baggy and a crop top.
How dare you come for me like this on the call? No one needed to know that I'm wearing an oversized Scooby-Doo monster truck shirt that but I have cropped. You cut? Yeah.
Wow.
I think we needed to know, George.
I can't believe this. I can't believe I'm being bullied on air.
So when is the appointment for you to get your bull ring?
Listen, I don't want to talk about it, but I have been talking to my friends about getting a septum piercing. This is the worst day of my life.
Let's move on.
Please.
Everybody stop looking at Georgia.
Stop looking at me. I'm turning my camera off.
There are two comments that I just wanted to call out as being good and interesting. The first is Nick Sherefkin sent us an email with a bunch of thoughts about the title of the show and about the nature of the internet that were just, they're too good for me to like try to summarize. So I will put some of them in the show notes for this. But one of the things that Nick ends on is this thought that it is perhaps the case that journal publication-based academia is ground zero for posting disease.
Oh, no.
Similar symptoms. People contributing to discourses they no longer even enjoy. Huge amounts of work adjudicating distinctions with little practical difference. Total inscrutability to outsiders, etc., etc. And my single addition to this is made all the more worse because you have to pay to post, and the posts take sometimes decades to finish.
It's like Ents posting.
It's just, oh, that's bleak. Bleak.
What a way to characterize the project of knowledge.
That's beautiful. That's a beautiful thing.
Beautiful. Nick, we look forward to hearing from you again. The other is, I called this out specifically in the introduction of episode 2, but Ronald reached out, and Ronald I got it wrong in the episode. Ronald is a psychiatric clinical pharmacist, and Ronald was the one that made the comments about the suitability of posting disease being in the DSM. Ronald sent a lot of really interesting thoughts about the segment. The first one that I want to share is his reaction to us using the word madness being simply ew. Which, fair. It says kind of cringe, kind of a cringe word these days, but I get why they used it.
Yeah, you're right.
And then though. the other is this idea that like,
very true.
It is not the posting or even the repetitive posting that is the problem. It is when it becomes a problem. It is when the repetitive posting interferes with other things. And so Ronald talks through ways that you might think about this and ends with this sort of formulation of, should posting disease be considered for inclusion in the next edition of psychiatry's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual? Well, I don't know, but I don't think it's silly to ask. Then after hearing episode 2, Ronald reached out and said that the DSM was looking at including something on internet gaming disorder, which is a preoccupation with internet games, withdrawal symptoms when internet gaming is taken away, the need to spend increasing amounts of time engaged in internet games, all these other things that you sort of, I think, appreciate as being signs of an addiction of some kind. Ronald overall gives the APA a D+ on the way that they frame this potential disorder. One of the points that is made is use of internet games to escape or relieve negative mood, which Ronald contextualizes saying, this sounds like we're stigmatizing a hobby. Ronald also suggests that there is a way to appreciate internet gaming disorder where you sort of replace gaming with internet And it, you know, doesn't not make sense. And so perhaps in the future, there is room for something like, I want to make sure I get this right, maladaptive social internet use disorder.
Wow.
I have such strong thoughts on this. I just really don't think that using like the framework of addiction and pathologizing behaviors is ever going to help us like wrangle with like the rules of like culture and agency. And I think that like it leads to like moral panics. It leads to like thinking that these problems arise from like biological, either from a biological interaction with a technology, or like that there's some moral component to technology. And I don't think it helps us ask the right questions about what's really happening culturally, socially, politically with our interactions with these systems as we create them. And I really want us to maybe in a future episode do a deeper dive on like, is pathologizing and naming disorders around technology, is that helpful? What do we, I would love to hear what everyone thinks, but I'm not into it. My dog is now chewing a bone. So if you hear a dog chewing a bone, just enjoy
that. The animals
that.
Of Neverpost are strong right now. There's something in the vibes.
Open revolt.
So did we do an okay thing by having a, basically trying to develop a taxonomy of what this thing is? Or are we contributing to that problem?
I feel like only time will tell, unfortunately.
No, I think it's, I think the way that we were discussing it was trying to get at what's happening and how are people feeling? How are people reacting? But I don't think we were adding like new categories to a diagnostic manual.
No. I will say for my part, as a white man that shares his thoughts on a podcast, I think we're fine.
Oh, thank God.
I don't think we did anything wrong. I've conducted an internal investigation and I have found that we are not at fault.
Yeah, I'm drawing the line on adding new DSM-5 categories.
Because that's highly structural. Please. Yeah.
God, your confidence fills me with such confidence. Really, I feel taken care of.
What's that like? What's that like?
Oh, I'm not a confident white man. I just play one on the internet.
I just play one on TV.
Oh, no. Yeah, no. Riddled with anxiety and self-doubt. Okay. And with that, we are going to take a quick break and we are going to say goodbye to Jason and Audrey, who have to leave.
Sorry to miss the rest. Have fun, everybody.
So thank you for joining us for discussing episode 1. Hans and Georgia and I are going to stick around and talk about episode 2 and 3 right after this.
American Hysteria is a podcast that explores fantastical thinking, moral panics, and urban legends to understand how they've long shaped our culture. With topics like stranger danger, the gay agenda, satanic cults, the Westboro Baptist Church, and phantom clowns, the show is sometimes hilarious, sometimes horrifying, and sometimes heartfelt. I'm Chelsea Weber-Smith, and you can subscribe to American Hysteria wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there. Hans Buto, senior producer for Never Post here. You know what we do in this part of the show. We ask you to help us. And there are, as always, a couple of ways you can help us. You can become a subscriber to the show if you aren't. Rad. Love that. You can tell a friend to listen. Double red. Double love that. Review on iTunes. Fabulous. All of those are incredible and actually really helpful ways to support the show. And we appreciate all of them. But there's one specific thing that you can do for us right now that would really help the show. And that is to send us your voice. Here's the thing. I am working on a couple of new interstitials. So that's the interludes, the pauses, the moments of reflection that we build into each episode. And we want your stories for those interstitials. We want things like, what is your favorite hidden corner of the internet? Or what was the best computer you ever owned?
Head over to neverpo.st/interstitials to see all of the prompts that you can respond to. We will keep updating that list because we'd love to hear from you about a lot of things. So, neverpo.st/interstitials. There's also a link in the show notes.
Let's talk about some listener comments on episode 2. Hans, Georgia, you ready?
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, our first comment comes from Kevin. Kevin sent a comment about some of Lisa's perspective on a community transfer of sound change. So this idea that, like, while people are hanging out together, that is when sound change in speech actually takes place. And Kevin said this.
Hey guys, it's Kevin. I love the new episode. I just had a quick comment about the influencer voice segment with Lisa B. Davidson. So in the segment, she talks about how, linguistic trends that are happening on places like TikTok or Instagram maybe don't move through communities in the same way that they do when people are actually gathering in real space and speaking to one another. And I think that's a good point. But when she was talking about these influencers, she said something along the lines of, you're not interacting with these people, we're just watching them. And I think that for the majority of, TikTok users in particular, that's true. There's a lot more people that just watch TikToks than actually watch and make them. But I do wonder if she's missing something about an actual distributed online community forming among the influencers themselves, because of course, these influencers are watching each other's videos. And so the sense that they're all coalescing around one new way of speaking, I think, is an example of community exchange, even if it's distributed, happening through the internet and not in real space. So I think, something was a little bit missed there. And even Mike, in his talking about his own experience, he talked about, watching Hank Green videos and actually trying to talk like him. So that's an example of, even if it's somebody that you're not with in real life, or maybe you've not even met, of a community forming among video producers who are all kind of imitating one another. And obviously that's a little different than, hanging out like in a bar together and starting to talk similar to one another. But it strikes me as, more similar than different. And I feel like a real community exchange is happening there, which the guest seemed to discount. So I just wanted to make that comment.
Okay. I have a lot of thoughts about this. And yeah. I want to preface my lots of thoughts with, I am not Lisa and I am not a linguist.
Yeah.
But I wonder the difference between the community transfer of a sound change in speech and the sort of like professional development of a performance style. And so what I think about when I listen to Kevin's comment is whether or not newscasters get together and talk like newscasters to one another when they get drinks at like conferences. Yeah. And my guess is no, but it is a very funny thing to imagine.
Please let it be yes.
Or like pilots talking like pilots on intercoms.
Exactly.
Or like,
John? How are
Mike, good to see you.
The kids.
I hope you are doing really well.
Oh my God. Spot on, fellas.
Because I think of like, I can only speak to this from my personal experience, but it's like when I used to do a lot of YouTube stuff and I was hanging out with people who did YouTube stuff, when we were all hanging out together in a social scenario, did we talk that way to one another?
Yeah.
And I mean, while that was a while ago, but I think the answer was no. I think that we did not. I think that we talked the way that we talked, and that, then when the camera is on, you start talking the way that you talk on camera. Right? I was trying to sound like Hank on camera, but not trying to sound like Hank when talking to Hank.
I think that's the critical question. That's the question I have for you, Mike, is how much do you think that work changed how you speak normally to like your mom?
That was the next thing I was going to say is like, I think this is complicated though by the fact that like that line gets blurry and that I definitely changed the way that I talk in all parts of my life.
Yeah.
in response to the things that I learned how to do, making YouTube videos and now making podcasts.
Yeah.
That being said, it's not as extreme, I don't think. You know, it's not as performative. It is not as heightened.
I think about those figures that Dr. Davison talked about, the names of which I can't remember, but that Bill Labov, the researcher in Philadelphia,
the sound transfer guy, yeah.
He's the one who identified these often, almost always, women who have lots of social connections, who are like the drivers of these changes within their communities. And I think the question is, who is the focal point of the community that Kevin is identifying in his question? If the focal point of the community is the influencer, then possibly. But if it's a person who's consuming the things of the influencer, are they likely to be the one? Because they have their own inner person. They have the people around them. And I think if you're part of a community and everyone is constantly watching these influencers talk and everyone is adjusting with each other all the time, then maybe they have transferred that role onto the influencer. But I read Dr. Davison's point as being, it's almost impossible to give the influencer that role. And that while there's a community, there's not a linguistic community.
Yeah.
That exists in that format. That's how I read what she was saying.
I gotta know if Alex Earle is hanging out with her pals and talking in that clipped up talky, you know, end extending way in person. And I think she probably has a characteristic way of talking, but I would be surprised if it's as pronounced as it is in her videos. For, you know, performance reasons, for the reason that she is often doing a performance, I would assume. And also, like Lisa said, a lot of those things are technologically determined, that the rhythm and clippedness of speech is a direct result of editing.
I also think, though, the TikTok voice, the TikTok influencer voice, has something unique about it compared to something like YouTuber voice, because these TikTok influencers are in a way trying to bring you into their normal life. So I think it would be very possible that they speak more similarly to this. I do think there's still going to be a difference, because once the camera's on, it's different. You like everything sort of heightens in a way, I think. But I think I wouldn't be surprised if some of these linguistic qualities of someone like Alex Earle do exist off camera when she's talking to her friends, because that's the nature of the scenario in which she's letting you in, that this is like a quotidian daily experience of her. It's not her teaching you necessarily about something. Do you know what I mean?
Our next comment comes from a friend of the show and friend of mine, Matt Storm, who says something that to me is scary.
Hi, this is Matt, aka Stormageddon. I have known Mike Rugnetta over quite a few years now. And when I had the bizarre realization during episode 2, an influencer voice talk, that I, like Mike before me, was influenced by someone I respected who I watched. Because before knowing Mike, I was a huge fan of the Idea Channel and how Mike spoke on that program. And now I realize, having 3 podcasts to my name, having done many live streams and YouTube videos, that I too modeled, maybe even unconsciously, a little bit about how I talk similarly to Mike, who similarly to Hank Green, and kind of broke my brain a little bit. It makes me wonder, though, because I don't recall, like Mike says in the episode, he went out of his way to do that. I, however, don't, like, I think I might have clocked that it was pleasing to hear how these creators talked, but I don't know that I ever said, I'm going to learn to talk like Mike, but I can definitely hear it. Now that it's been pointed out, maybe not identically, but definitely there's an influence. It makes me wonder, can you do this unconsciously? Is this a thing that you can just fall into like other dialects or languages or accents, since it's not quite an accent? I don't know. I don't have a good answer for that, but I'm definitely curious. Anyway, great job, Mike. Love the show. Love all the folks working over there with you. Keep up the cool stuff. This has been Matt.
I have a question for you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think Matt sounds like me?
Maybe a little bit. Okay. I feel like it's not fair, though, because the second he said it, now I'm like, okay, hold on.
Getting out the magnifying glass.
Wait a second. What I was going to ask you is, How does it feel to be a thought leader, Mike?
A voice leader. Sorry, I can't hear you. The wind is whipping at the edge of the bridge.
So is it unconscious? I think you clearly outlined it as being a conscious choice for you, right, Mike, when you were making these changes?
Yeah, yeah. And but I think it absolutely, you know, this is like what Lisa, this to me is related to something that Lisa said, which is you want your podcast to sound like a podcast. You want your YouTube videos to sound like YouTube videos. And so you might just sort of step by step get your way towards what it is that you have to do in order for that to be the case without sitting down and being like, okay, here's my checklist of things I have to change.
The voice has we understand how to read voices so much more powerfully evolutionarily than we do reading or other sorts of cues. And I think we absorb most of it unconsciously, actually. I mean, like, how were we able just to suddenly slip into pilot voice earlier?
Yeah. I was going to say that it's just the same thing. It's the same thing as if I was to give you a prompt of like, okay, give me a read as if you're a lead anchor on the evening news. Like, you know exactly
what that is. Hans, you first.
Well, but it depends. What are we doing? Are we doing like a, and in other news today, an iguana fell out of a tree? Like, is it that sort of thing? Or is it?
Where they're like, thank God, the fluff piece.
Yeah.
Dog knows how to speak and spell.
Yeah. And then you have like these layers, right? Like, am I actually doing Ron Burgundy doing an anchor, or am I doing the anchor version itself? And I mean, this is how accents work, right? Of like, do a British accent. You can do a British accent even if you haven't consciously practiced it.
Nobody's doing a British accent right now.
That's
don't
sure.
do it.
That is 1,000% true.
Molly's English, so I'm allowed.
Listen, that's your prerogative.
Governor.
In it?
I think it's absolutely unconscious. I think the majority of the nuance of it is unconscious. Whether or not you're making the decision, you just know how to code switch.
Our next voice memo is from Bennett Williamson, who has some things to say about Merlin and using apps to listen to the world.
Hey, NeverPost. This is Bennett. I enjoyed the Merlin segments on the last show, and I like using Merlin a lot. And I was thinking recently about how it's like a classic artist sound walk exercise where as soon as you hit record, you start listening super actively to the world around you and noticing all these sounds that you hadn't paid attention to. And another app that I've been using recently for the same effect is Strava, actually. And while I think Strava is created more about like capturing your data and competing against other people and like being the fastest in this segment, the way I'm using it is more just like for walks or like casual exercise. And similarly, like pressing record focuses me on where I am in the world. And I stop a lot more. I take more pictures. I'm like putting my little notes in there about the urban planning or the urban environment, taking pictures of like bulletin boards or lichen or whatever. And yeah, it's really nice. My friend Mark said he likes Strava because you only get to post if you're getting out there. And I was like, yeah, that's like when I want to be posting, you know, like, look at me, I went for a walk. So I would recommend using Strava wrong. It's been working for me.
For anyone who doesn't know, Strava is a running app. It tracks how and where you run.
Yeah. I also just love this comparison to an artist sound walk, because that it's just, I don't really have much else to say about it other than that's just such a beautiful perspective to approach something like Merlin or Strava from. That's just such a wonderful way of kind of jailbreaking it.
I think this phenomenon is very real. It's been really encouraging to have felt these things about Merlin for a while now, experienced them, shared them with some of the people on the team, now shared them with the public, and have people like Bennett say this back, because it makes me feel like there is a thing about it. Now I want to look more into it about like the recording effect. I'm sure people have talked about it and studied it. It's not a thing I've ever looked into, but it's a thing I've absolutely experienced. And it's part of the reason that I do this work, I think, is just to pay attention to the world differently. You hit record and the world changes, and it changes when you're doing video or audio or any sort of recording or steps. Like, all of that stuff changes your relationship to it. The relationship is mediated differently suddenly. And I think the only thing that I will add is, like, this is exactly why one of the big things that I encourage people to do is record their family members, is to sit down and just on your phone hit record when you're talking to your family, because it will change the way you talk. And I think a lot of people are scared of that change, that it feels too formal and it doesn't feel natural, but it's focused in a way that you might not have in other ways. You will pay attention differently. They will say something differently. It allows you to have a different interaction and pay different attention to the people you love in your life. And I think that it's a valuable thing to have later, but it's equally valuable to experience in the moment because it does change that dynamic. So keep using it wrong, Bennett. Like, there is no wrong. This is not wrong. This is the focus of recording. And
if anything, this is more right than the app knows.
It's the right? only way.
Okay, let's chat about episode 3. If anybody needs a refresher, in episode 3, Georgia talked to Tamara Nice about the software infrastructure that does and mostly does not support the mourning and grieving process online. And I talked about men who throw ping pong balls into cups. A real 1-2 punch of an episode.
Reductive but accurate.
Whatever you need, we got it.
So naturally, our first question is then about human evolution.
Hi, quick question. If people keep getting taller, how tall are people going to be in like 500 years? Thanks. Bye.
So that's my wife.
I was just going to say, I was like, I know that voice.
I think this might end up being a space where we just answer Molly's questions sometimes.
Good question.
Molly's corner.
So yeah, we'll make a little theme for Molly's corner right here. I went and looked this up. It is true that over the last 150 or so years, the human race has slowly gotten taller. And
we're talking
so,
on average, right?
Or on median, average.
On average.
Yep. And that is largely pegged to improving nutrition across the world.
That makes sense.
Yep. Cool. And so the question it then arises, I think it makes sense. Will that just continue? Will we continue to get to, if nutrition keeps getting better or if nutrition stays the same, like, will people just generally get taller and taller and taller as the human race persists for hundreds, if not thousands of years? And the answer appears to be no, that there is a maximum height that the human genome sort of allows us to get to. And that, in fact, it appears as though, given global conditions, we are getting shorter because nutrition improved and now it is disimproving.
Oh, that's well,
yeah, sad.
Topic for another time.
Sad and bad. Sorry, this has been Molly's Corner.
For better or worse.
Our first voicemail about episode 3 comes from someone who shares some thoughts about a friend of theirs that died.
A recent segment about death and the internet got me thinking about a time in 2009 where this upperclassman that I knew had graduated and moved out to Silicon Valley, like most upperclassmen in my school tended to do. And we used to chat. We used to chat all the time on IRC, Internet Relay Chat. And it was cool. It was cool to see him online. It was cool to hear about his life. But I guess he didn't share everything, and he committed suicide sometime after leaving college. And the thing about Internet Relay Chat is that unless you log off your client or your computer, you're still online. And had a weird moment of being able to chat with the dead. He didn't obviously chat back, but it was a weird moment of closure, and just got me thinking about that moment again. Anyway, love the show. Thanks.
So, I mean, Georgia, I would love to hear what you think about this. My initial thought of it is just like, it's really beautiful to hear about technology not designed to support the grieving process that does anyway. And it seems like the way that it does that is just by staying out of people's way.
Yes. Oh my God. Yeah. I feel the exact same way, where I think this is a moment that I'm sure has been repeated countless times with other people where, yeah, the structure of any given platform, the software that allows for communication on a platform, just by virtue of continuing to exist and not involving itself in any larger way, can serve as this space where, I mean, like this person said, you can just continue communicating with someone even though you know they've died, and have kind of this tangible, it's weird to call it tangible, yeah, because it doesn't, it's on the internet, it's not actually tangible, but like in a way, yeah, like this space.
It's emotionally tangible.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe, I mean, I think that is what's most important here.
This makes me think of when I was a kid, one of my aunts died, and she had a like old school voicemail machine. Like, I forget what we used to call them, but like the one that plugged into the phone that was its own little tape player that recorded messages on tape. You would get home, you would push the button, it would rewind, like all that stuff.
Cool.
And, her family just kept her outgoing message. She was the one who recorded the outgoing message. And then every year, for years, people would just call and like wish her a happy birthday. Or like say like, hey, I was thinking about you, like just whatever. And it was like, in a weird way, the tape in the machine like became her.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, but it was like just this totally normal, like, I'm going to give her a call and just say hi.
It's so funny you use that as an example, because while we were listening, it made me think of that, of even pre-internet having a space like a voicemail box where you can hear that person's voice. It is immortalized to a degree, and you can't, it becomes like a log. It becomes a space where you can send this person thoughts and have this one-sided communication with them, but that feels like more.
It's still animated in some way. There's some sort of like, there's some animism to it, even if it's not life.
Yeah. And I think it's kind of this procedural ritualistic nature of it, like of leaving a message, of how normal that is. I think of it feels even kind of different than, you know, going to someone's grave and like talking to them, which is also a common practice, but like something about this being so normal and so part of just daily life, in the same way that, yeah, being in like a chat room is just instantly accessible. It's not an event. It's not you going to the place where this body has been laid to rest. It is just part of your daily life. And you get to engage with this person in a very, I don't know, it's a different way.
I want to follow up with maybe a irritating question. maybe not irritating questions, the wrong frame for this. I don't want to respond to any specific comments that we were sent, but I know that Georgia, you and Hans both have a lot to say about people who think there is a right way to express their grief in public, or I guess more specifically, people who think there is a wrong way that you should express your grief, that there are things that if you are a grieving person, you just, you know, the laws of the world dictate that you should not do them. It seems like chief amongst them being make any content TM about it. So I feel like this is something that we could probably talk for a long, long time about.
Oh, yes.
But I just want to clear some space at this moment for you guys to just have some of those thoughts in public.
Yeah. So I think it's very difficult to trust anything that has a sheen of earnestness to it on the internet. I think it is very tempting to be online socially with an air of skepticism or bitterness or distrust. And I think there are countless ways in which that is valuable, because online, it does often feel like we are always being sold something. We are being given a narrative of something that isn't always necessarily true. We're seeing a version of something that was given to us, curated and made particularly for us to see and not to see something else. I understand that. But I think, I mean, as I said in the segment, and as is abundantly true, grief and loss and mourning are experiences that just cannot ever exist in a neat, codified way. People experience grief very differently from one another, and it can be very uncomfortable to witness that, especially if you're on a social platform in which, for example, a video about someone talking about grieving or sharing their experience with it kind of comes at you out of nowhere. Like, you don't seek it out. It just sort of happens to you. And that can be extremely jarring. It can make you feel very uncomfortable. It can make you feel like, why would someone do this? I think that's a question that I imagine quite a lot of people have, is be like, why document this? This is supposed to be something private. This is supposed to be personal. Why are you putting it here in this public place? But I also think that grief, and especially the experience of it, is a profoundly isolating feeling if you've ever experienced it at any level. Doesn't have to be the loss of a parent or someone extremely close to you. Like, it is like designed to isolate you. It is designed to never be something someone else really can understand in the same way. But what I think is kind of an incredible component of the social internet is having a space in which you can reach out. You can reach out your hand and be like, I'm experiencing this like no other thing. Just
yeah, there doesn't need to be a second thought. It can just be.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think that's extremely risky, because you're basically going into like the town square of the entire world and being like, hello.
I feel bad.
Yeah, I feel scared and sad. Hello, anyone? And so you're going to obviously get some people who are like, boo.
Just don't feel that way.
I hate that you're doing this.
And also keep it to yourself.
Yeah. But like something that didn't make it into the episode, but was very impactful to me about that TikTok I mentioned of the woman picking up her husband's ashes, is I immediately went to all the comments, and there's like thousands of them. And I'm certain that some of them are these horrible trolls who are like, stop crying, woman, or whatever, like, or just like, I hate that you're doing this. But so many of them, I mean, countless of them, as the ones I saw, the only sentiment was basically of witnessing and completely understanding. I mean, I saw comments from people being like, I had to do this exact thing 2 weeks ago. I just had to do this. Or I lost my husband 2 years ago. I think about him every day. I know exactly what feeling you're feeling. Like, just thousands and thousands of comments like this. And I can't imagine how comforting that would be.
People use the word grief porn in this way. And that puritanicism, to me, is kind of what's at the heart of this. I question whether such a thing actually exists, because it's such a personal experience, exactly like Georgia said. But I want to approach it actually from a different perspective of, like, this, to me, comments like that people should be careful about what they post online or shouldn't be putting their grief in front of me, to me, speaks to, you know, the a crisis of emotional intelligence that we are experiencing in this country, in this world more generally, which is leading to a lot of problems. And that is that, like, those people, which is that people have no problem with insanely graphic depictions of death, as long as there is no mention of the emotionality of grief. We are surrounded with the violence of the world and the death of the world, but we are chastised for having any feelings about it. And I think that is something that we should examine a lot more closely as a group. And I think all of us can examine a lot more closely as individuals.
Let's end on I think this is a positive note. We got an email from Taylor Anderson, who talks about what is left behind on the internet when a person dies. And Taylor says, I think about a lot of the things that I put a lot of time into that my loved ones would not be aware of unless I specifically told them about it. Like, my AO3 account is under a pseudonym. My Letterboxd account has public reviews and kind thoughts about my family that I've never said to their faces that I can safely write, because no one in my family has any idea what Letterboxd is. is. My notes app is completely unintelligible to anyone who isn't me. All of these things would still exist if I died today, but it would be so easy for any one of these to slip through the cracks, especially if I never chose to tell them or forgot about them myself. And even if they weren't lost immediately, they're all subject to whatever company is in charge of that particular space continuing to pay the server costs, which obviously will not be the case indefinitely. I'm of two minds about this. On the one hand, it's a little sad to think that everything so important to me now will disappear, some immediately after I do. But on the other hand, that's always kind of been true. I mean,
Taylor, I love this.
It's so good. I know it's sad, but I think the ephemerality of a lot of these things is what makes these things so powerful.
Yeah.
I get mad, I think, about the ephemerality of the internet a lot because it defeats sometimes the active choices that people make to like circumvent it. But like there's also some part of me that's like having all these places where you can share yourself that then can just kind of disappear after a while is also kind of nice as long as you got to choose that they disappear and also have the stable record of your, you know, interior existence.
Yeah. And that is the problem. you often don't get to choose.
Yeah.
But Taylor, I love this. I love this comment. I've thought about it so much because doing this segment very much made me confront something that now feels so obvious to me, which is the temporality of the online world. Because I think there was a huge degree of my experience with it that felt like this was forever. I mean, there's a lot of language around that, right? Like the idea of like, oh yeah, well, if you delete something from Facebook, it's still there. It's in their data somewhere, but you deleted it, but it's going to be online forever. Like that whole idea of like, once something's online, it's online forever, in quotes, is kind of not totally true. I mean, especially not true because I think there's just so much more transientness. There's such a transient quality to the internet that I think, I mean, Taylor's totally right. That has always been true. People like, you know, hate to break it to you, but like eventually everything of yours will be lost to time. You will be lost to time. You will cease to exist. And the things you've left behind will cease to exist. And I think that is always going to be weird and uncomfortable and unsettling. And it's almost like we have to realize that again with the social internet.
Okay, that's the end of our first mailbag. Thank you, everybody, for joining us and for sharing your thoughts on thoughts. Thanks for everybody who listened, who sent things in. If you want to send us anything else that you would like us to respond to, please do. We love hearing from you, and we're going to do more of these. I think we're going to aim to do them maybe every 3 episodes? ?
Yeah, something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
3 or 4 episodes? So, yeah, and we'll give you some notice the next time we have one coming on the horizon so you can make sure you get your thoughts in. Yeah, that's what we got. Thanks, all.
Bye.
Bye.
TFN.